Honorable Court is again in session. Be seated, please. Case number 10-9092, Tailpipe Rural. Mr. Glasser, for the petitioners. Mr. Hotstetler, for the respondents. Mr. Lewinsky, for Intervenors Global Automakers et al., and Mr. McCabe, for Intervenors State of California.
Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Peter Glazer for petitioners American Farm Bureau Federation, National Mining Association, and Peabody Energy. With me at council table is Ashley Parrish for the Portland Cement Association and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time, if I could, for rebuttal. And I'd like to address two issues this morning. The first issue is our contention that the motor vehicle rule is unlawful because EPA failed to consider during the motor vehicle rulemaking the consequences of the stationary source regulation that EPA says is automatically triggered by issuance of the motor vehicle rule. And second, I'd like to address our contention that the motor vehicle rule itself is unlawful because EPA failed to rationally relate its motor vehicle standards to the endangerment risk on which the rule was based. So first, we'll talk about the stationary source implications of the motor vehicle rule, and then the motor vehicle rule itself. First, on the stationary source issue itself, at the heart of EPA's position in this case, we think, is a fundamental and indeed remarkable contradiction. Because on the one hand, one of EPA's central positions across all of the cases that this Court is considering today and tomorrow is its position that its issuance of the motor vehicle greenhouse gas regulations automatically and as a matter of law triggered stationary source greenhouse gas regulation. So before issuance of the motor vehicle rule, stationary sources were not regulated for greenhouse gases. After the motor vehicle rule, they were. But on the other hand, EPA claims that it was not obligated to consider the costs and benefits and other consequences of stationary source regulation during the motor vehicle rulemaking because, according to EPA, it didn't regulate stationary sources. Its own action did not result in stationary source regulation. It was Congress's action that did that. But it seems to us that EPA cannot have it both ways. Either the action EPA took in issuing the motor vehicle rules only resulted in motor vehicle regulation, in which case EPA is absolutely correct that it would not have to consider stationary source impacts, or, on the other hand, the action EPA took in promulgating the motor vehicle regulations resulted in both regulation of motor vehicles and regulation of stationary sources, and that is EPA's position. In that case, our position is that EPA violated basic principles of reasoned rulemaking, the Clean Air Act, and a number of statutes and executive orders by failing to consider its regulation in light of the impacts on both motor vehicles and stationary.
Do you have 202A1 in front of you there?
I'm sorry?
Do you have 202A1 in front of you there? Show us where in that language EPA would have the ability to account for anything other than endangerment.
It is not our contention, in fact, that EPA would have to look at stationary source impacts but for EPA's conclusion.
That wasn't my question. I'm asking you a question about statutory interpretation. Where in 202A1, set aside the inconsistency in their argument, if there is one, where would EPA get the authority in 202A1 to take account of anything other than endangerment to public health and welfare?
I think our argument here, Your Honor, is that it's EPA's position that reading the statute as a whole, this is not our position. This is EPA's position that by reading the statute as a whole, when they issue the motor vehicle regulations, they trigger stationary source consequences.
Don't you think that if EPA said we're not going to make an endangerment finding because of its consequences for stationary sources, the Supreme Court would reverse them for the same reason they did in Mass v. EPA?
But issuing or not issuing an endangerment finding is not the only option that the agency had here.
It isn't? What else could it have done given Mass v. EPA?
Sure. And keep in mind...
There's nothing but an and in front of now. I answer that question.
I'm sorry.
In light of Mass versus EPA, what were their options other than finding endangerment or not finding endangerment?
Yes, but if we could just step back 1 second, and I will answer that question, but if we step back and we see what EPA has done here...
Look, you can step back as much as you want, but we're bound by 202A1, or at least the agency is.
Uh-huh.
And the agency's authority comes from that statute as interpreted by the Supreme Court of Mass v. EPA. So for you to succeed here, you have to show us where EPA would have this authority under this statute as interpreted by Mass v. EPA.
Yes.
That's the question.
Sure.
Now, maybe there's some arbitrary and capriciousness somewhere lurking behind that, but you have to start with the statute.
Yes.
And I haven't heard an answer to that question yet.
No, and we agree with that, but part of the problem...
Agree with what?
We agree that you have to start with the statute,
oh.
But the fundamental problem that petitioners have had all through this case
uh-huh.
is EPA saying that stationary source impacts are going to be triggered as a matter of law, and when we have tried to dispute that and tell EPA that that is not the case, or when EPA says stationary source impacts are triggered, and that automatically what happens from that is we end up with regulation that is so broad and so absurd that EPA then has to take the facially unlikely step of tailoring statutory thresholds.
What was EPA's option other than to issue or not issue an endangerment finding? Issue a finding of endangerment or say we can't find endangerment?
Your Honor, what we are trying to say here is that in the context of EPA's application of the absurdity canon in tailoring the statutory thresholds under the law, under the cases they cite, and in particular under the MOVA case, EPA was obligated to pick a statutory construction, if one was possible, to avoid the absurdity. And our central position in the motor vehicle regulation is that they had options at that point during the motor vehicle rulemaking to avoid the absurdity that they said would happen later on. And
look,
those options would have been apparent to them had they considered stationary source impacts.
Didn't Mass v. EPA say that once they had found the endangerment, that they then had to regulate if they found endangerment and had to base that on the scientific judgments involved in the finding of endangerment? Did it say anything about considering further implications?
All that we're saying here, however, is that EPA didn't have to issue the particular motor vehicle regulations that they did issue. They didn't have to issue them at the time that they issued them, and they had options in construing the statute that would have broken the chain at the motor vehicle stage.
Then look at 202A2. That's now, they do have flexibility under 202A2.
Yes,
I agree.
That is an argument that the states made in their brief, that in looking at cost of compliance under 202A2, if EPA's view is that we're triggering stationary source impacts, then those costs of compliance should be considered under 202A2.
You're not embracing that argument?
We are embracing that argument, but we are suggesting that there is an additional argument as well, and at least...
Hey, then let me go back to Mass v. I mean, the Supreme Court sometimes doesn't speak as clearly as we would like it to. I mean, we know that. We have to apply their opinions. But listen to what it says in Mass v. EPA. It says, while the statute does condition the exercise of EPA authority on its judgment, that judgment must relate to whether an air pollutant causes or contributes to air pollution, which may reasonably be expected to endanger. Must relate to that. Now, so where is there any flexibility after Mass v. EPA to consider anything other than that?
Yeah, I am not trying here in this
where?
Motor vehicle part of the rule to re-argue what Mr. Clark argued, which we endorse.
Well, who
argued? Mr. Clark.
Oh.
Who was addressing absurdity in the context of the endangerment finding, who was saying that one construction of the statute that EPA could have adopted that would
really
have avoided...
I'd really like you to answer my question about Mass v. EPA.
My
question is, as an inferior court, which we are here, we have to follow the opinions of the Supreme Court. And even if I agreed with you about this, assume for a minute I agree with you that it just doesn't make any sense to make this endangerment finding if you know what its consequences are and you don't know and you don't account for those consequences. That's your argument. Explain how this court is free to go there in view of what the court said in Mass v. EPA.
Because
that's my question.
Right. Because Massachusetts versus EPA did not foreclose the ability of EPA to say that in looking at the regulatory consequences that are going to be triggered by issuance of the motor vehicle rule, if those regulatory consequences are going to be so absurd that EPA feels that it has authority to tailor the statutory thresholds, to change the statutory thresholds, that EPA can then look back at links of the chain and say, was there a way to avoid triggering this absurdity? This is our entire point.
Now, I know the absurdity doctrine applies to statutes. I've never heard it applied to a Supreme Court decision. I mean, our rule is the Supreme Court has made very clear that we are to follow its decisions. It's up to the court to change its decisions.
But
this and so if they left something out here, if because of this language, it, quote, must relate. That's what they're saying. The judgment must relate to it. And they talk about a scientific judgment later. If because of that language, you know, there's some factor that they should consider, it seems to me you need to make that argument with the Supreme Court. I don't see where this court has the flexibility to disregard language like that.
Yeah, I think, Judge Tatel, that you're focusing again here on the endangerment finding itself and not the motor vehicle regulation. If we were to focus...
Well, then that's my point. Then doesn't that bring us to 202A2? Because I understand your point about that. Once you make the endangerment finding, then they go ahead and regulate under 202A2, right? That's why I asked you that question.
Yes,
that's where they get their flexibility.
That's correct. But we could then ask the question that if EPA's view is that by the naked fact of issuing the motor vehicle regulations leads automatically to this triggering effect.
Yeah, but where do you get that under 202A2? 202A2 looks to me like it can take account of, it can delay it, it can craft it, but to take account of the cost of compliance of those regulations.
Yeah, but
the motor vehicle regulations.
Sure, but our only point here is that EPA had options at the motor vehicle regulatory stage for avoiding the absurdity that it saw as inevitable.
What should it have done to avoid that?
Yes.
What options are we talking about?
Sure. There were several options that EPA had. First of all, and we're going to hear more about this tomorrow, had it considered the stationary source impacts at the motor vehicle stage, it could have opted for a different interpretation of the statute under which the automatic triggering...
What different interpretation?
Under which they could have decided that in the PSD program could not have been intended to apply to greenhouse gases. They
could it have decided that in light of Massachusetts v. EPA?
Yes, Your Honor. We're going to argue that more tomorrow, and I don't want to steal counsel's thunder tomorrow. You'll hear another argument.
Now you're answering my question.
That's correct. That's correct. They had other options as well that will be discussed more tomorrow. But even in the context of just the motor vehicle rule, they had the option of deferring regulation for a period of time in order to avoid the absurdity whereby...
Didn't they defer it in part with respect to the stationary sources by not applying the strictest statutory threshold for the activation of the regulation of the stationary sources, the 250-100 that we're being told by other petitioners they couldn't have stayed above that threshold, but in effect, were they not deferring by choosing a standard for triggering their regulation that was higher than the 250-100?
No, we don't agree with that, Your Honor. We think that they have applied the absurdity canon to do something that they cannot do, that they had
it
other...
just said they could have deferred altogether. So if they can defer altogether, isn't it a lesser thing to say, well, we're not going to enforce it to its letter, at least for the time being?
No, I don't agree with that because
they have said,
first of all, they have not said that we are actually deferring PSD regulation forever. We don't
know. That's why I used the term in effect when I was
Right, because we don't actually.
Right now, they're not enforcing to the letter of 250-100 with respect to stationary sources, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, right now, they're not.
That's correct. So our.
So let me take you back to the language of the statute then. So your point is, looking at 202A1, that you're focusing on the language shall by regulation prescribe, right?
Yes.
Okay, and your point, I just want to make sure I understand your argument. Your point is that because of the absurdity doctrine, the EPA should have invoked, I'm sorry, EPA should have invoked the absurdity doctrine then, at that point, right? And said, although the statute says shall by regulation prescribe, having made the endangerment finding, right? It says shall by regulation prescribe, taking account of the, quote, absurd results of doing that for stationary sources, right?
That's yes, but we are, I am not here suggesting that, again, if we start at the earliest link of the chain, we have the argument about the endangerment finding that Mr. Clark made.
Yeah, you're not
but
challenging
here,
that.
But here I am not saying that having made the endangerment finding, they were not required to issue a motor vehicle regulation of some sort at some point.
Uh-huh.
That is not what the argument is. The argument is, at what point should they have done that as an alternative to the absurdity that they saw coming? Or was there a way to structure the motor vehicle regulation?
But I just want to, we have to work within the statute. And that's why I asked you about this language, shall by regulate prescribe. So having made the endangerment finding, the statute requires them to issue a regulation, correct?
That's correct.
Are you saying that they should have issued, are you saying that at that point we move to 202A? Two, and it's a question of timing? Or is it, or are you saying that because of the consequences for sources other than motor vehicles, they could have chosen not to regulate motor vehicles?
I guess what I'm saying is that in light of EPA's position, that the issuance of the motor vehicle regulation is what triggers stationary source regulation,
right,
that is absurd. That EPA had a fundamental obligation to consider stationary source impacts, and that had it done that, it would have had other options more narrow to avoid the absurdity than the tailoring. I would also say that putting aside that argument completely, one of our central arguments here is that we cannot have the result that we have that has occurred here, which is that by issuing motor vehicle regulations, EPA has triggered stationary source regulation of such consequence, sweeping in so many sources, that EPA then had to take the unlikely step of tailoring statutory language. And then, even with
that, for tomorrow's case rather than today's.
No, because
if you ask questions, you want to tell us, we're going to hear about that tomorrow.
Yeah, but I guess all I'm saying, Judge Stentel, is this is a problem that we have had throughout the course of this, of these rulemakings, when EPA has basically said we're proceeding in different rules. Because when we try to raise these issues,
Vermont Yankee kind of thing, though, that they get to decide their procedural steps.
But yes, that's fine, and we are not saying as a matter of law the fact that they split this up into four steps is what the problem is. But the problem was that when we try to raise these issues at the endangerment finding stage, they say, no, bring it up in the motor vehicle stage. When we bring it up in the motor vehicle stage, they say, no, we're just talking about motor vehicles. We will address this when we get to stationary sources. But when we get to stationary sources, it's too late. The decision has already been made. You can't make this argument, and we are not going to talk about the costs and benefits of stationary source regulation. That's the main issue.
Other than not issuing a motor vehicle regulation under 202A1 that would trigger the regulation of stationary sources, what could the EPA have done differently to take account of the consequences for stationary sources than issue this regulation?
Yes. So I think going back to the answer that I gave earlier, they had the ability to interpret the statute differently than the way they did so that this triggering would not have happened.
But under their interpretation, which we've sustained, regulation under a regulation of a pollutant under the Act triggers regulation of stationary sources.
That's the,
and that wasn't also reconsidered by the EPA, no one, right? That's just an automatic result. In other words, no matter what sort of motor vehicle regulation they issued, it would have triggered stationary source regulation.
Well, correct? Sure, but that's their interpretation. That is, and what we are suggesting.
What we're asking for is yours. What is it they could have done other than not issue a motor vehicle regulation that would not have triggered regulation of stationary sources?
They could have changed their interpretation of the statute so that there was not an automatic triggering.
That's the issue for tomorrow, and that may be why petitioners prevail tomorrow, because the EPA's interpretation is not justified. But today the question is, did EPA have to consider the consequences for stationary sources when it issued the motor vehicle regulation? And I don't understand, since the issuance of the regulation itself automatically triggered, I don't understand what less they could have done.
The arguments that we made in the brief on what they could have done at the motor vehicle regulatory stage are twofold. And they both have to do with the fact that the EPA regulations at issue here are largely duplicative of the regulations issued by NHTSA.
I don't understand why that makes any difference.
It makes a difference.
Being duplicative of another agency's regulation does not. Each agency has its charge for regulating.
Yeah, you
and
also
Congress doesn't say. Right. You can forget about it if some other agency is doing it. They tell them what they have to do.
But the argument that I'm making here is it's not that they should have issued no regulation at all. I'm saying that because all of the climate benefits or all of the climate effects that they think that they will, EPA thinks it will avoid with its regulations are almost entirely avoided by NHTSA regulations, that would have allowed them to defer regulation of.
That could have been a choice they made, perhaps, but they had to do something. And it had to be some sort of regulation, didn't it, given the language of the statute?
At some point. Of course, the Supreme Court said that EPA had great latitude in terms of the type and timing of their regulations.
So all of your objection here is to their timing? Is that what
no,
you're saying?
No. In addition to timing, they had other alternatives that, for instance, included only regulating CFCs from air conditioners. This is, again, something where EPA said, to the extent that there is a difference in our regulation with NHTSA's regulations, it is because of air conditioning. So they could have said, well, in light of the fact that all of the benefits.
I would understand an argument that was about inconsistency with regulation by another agency so that a source could not comply with one without violating the other. But I'm not sure that I understand why it infringes or impinges upon the prerogatives of EPA that another agency also has regulatory authority.
But we are looking at this in EPA's own terms, which is they believe that the statutory course that they were on when they issued the motor vehicle regulation inevitably led to absurdity. And we are talking about whether or not there were alternative courses to reduce.
I think we've heard all that, and I
just asking
don't,
you.
Unless my just colleagues.
I just have one follow-up question to what the chief judge asked you. In response to his question, you said, well, they could have issued an air conditioning only rule, right?
I think I said they could issue an air conditioning only rule. EPA could have done that.
I just said.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
They could have issued an air conditioning only rule, right?
Yes.
Okay, so first question I have about that is that decision has no impact on your clients, right? I mean, any regulation issued under 202A1, even if it was limited to air conditioning, would have triggered stationary source regulation. So you don't really have standing to raise that kind of argument, do you?
No, because we're back in the six pollutant definition again.
Well, that's a different issue. I mean, I'm just saying that, I mean, aren't I right? If they had issued an air conditioning only rule, would that have automatically triggered stationary source regulation?
Under their view of the case, it would have triggered it for the CFCs that they were regulating.
Okay. I don't have any more questions. Yeah. I'm done.
You incident. All right, unless my colleagues have further questions, seeing none, thank you, counsel. We'll
thank you.
Give you back a little bit for rebuttal, and we'll hear from the respondent.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Eric Hostetler for the Department of Justice on behalf of EPA.
Good afternoon, counsel.
With me at counsel's table are Steve Silverman and John Hannon from EPA's Office of General Counsel, Raymond Ludfishevsky for the automobile interveners, and Gavin McCabe for the State of California. I will focus this morning on the non-discretionary nature of the duty in 202A1. EPA plainly did have a non-discretionary duty following its endangerment finding to proceed to promulgate greenhouse gas emission standards for new motor vehicles. And EPA has now appropriately fulfilled that duty with respect to light-duty vehicles. Petitioners here are not automobile manufacturers. They are not subject to these standards, nor are they contesting the substantive content of these standards in any respect. They have made clear that, in their view, EPA erred just by setting any emission standards at all following the endangerment finding. And in this regard, their argument really turns entirely on their position that 202A1 does not create any non-discretionary duty and provides some discretion for EPA not to act. They are wrong. Congress expressly directed EPA to set emission standards following an endangerment finding, and EPA did not err by doing precisely what Congress directed the agency to do in 202A1. There's nothing ambiguous about 202A1. It provides that EPA shall promulgate standards. Shall is a command. It admits of no discretion. If Congress had intended to provide EPA with some discretion, it would have used different language. Most obviously, it could have said that EPA may set standards as opposed to EPA shall set standards, but it used the word shall.
But what about their argument about the absurd, invoking the absurd result doctrine here, that 202A1 focusing on the phrase shall by regulation prescribe?
Your Honor, there's nothing in the text of section.
No, but there's never anything when you invoke the absurd results doctrine. That's why we have it, right?
I think this
we wouldn't need the doctrine.
This very line of reasoning that they advance was in fact rejected by
yourself. In fact, EPA itself relies on the absurd results doctrine when it gets to the tailoring rule.
First of all, in this rulemaking, EPA did not endeavor to interpret or implement the stationary.
I'm asking you the question. Their argument is that that's what EPA should have done here.
I'm trying to address what EPA's obligations were under the statute.
Right. You agree that agencies can invoke the absurd results doctrine when a statute produces a absurd result, right? That's the whole argument EPA's making
in tomorrow's case. If I could answer the
one of three arguments.
Yeah, one of three.
If I could answer the question, as you yourself, Your Honor, recognized in your opinion in the Massachusetts case, if...
That was a dissent.
It was a dissent, but I think the reasoning and logic fully applies here. You indicated that if... there was some unworkability with respect to greenhouse gases in other provisions of the Act other than Section 202, the absurd results doctrine would at most compel EPA to apply that doctrine to the particular unworkable provision, but would not in any way mean that EPA should not regulate under Section 202, particularly where everyone agrees that regulating automobile emissions is perfectly feasible. No one here is suggesting that it is at all absurd to set greenhouse gas emission standards for automobiles. And I'd like to...
Would it be an unfair paraphrase to say the absurd results doctrine, if it is valid at all, must be limited to the most narrow range of applicability possible to avoid the absurdity?
Yes, I think that's an accurate characterization, Your Honor. Moreover, the Supreme Court in Massachusetts did not leave any doubt as to the non-discretionary nature of 202A1. It stated that EPA shall promulgate standards if it makes an endangerment finding. It could hardly have reinforced the non-discretionary nature of the duty any more clearly.
Must relate to whether an air pollutant causes, contributes, etc.
Right. Assuming that the endangerment finding is proper, EPA then has an obligation to promulgate standards. And the Supreme Court, in its Massachusetts opinion, also specifically addressed and squarely rejected the argument that the Department of Transportation's authority to set fuel economy standards has some bearing on EPA's obligation to promulgate greenhouse gas standards.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I was just looking at Mass EPA. It says at the end of the opinion that they say we don't reach the question of whether EPA should make an endangerment finding, right? But then it says, or whether policy concerns can inform EPA's action in the event that it makes such a finding.
What's your question, Your Honor?
Well, that leaves open, I mean, that suggests that this language, it suggests that there's room for policymaking can inform EPA's judgment should it make an endangerment finding.
It might inform.
In other words, the Supreme Court doesn't seem to suggest it's quite as automatic under 202A1 as you suggest here.
I think what they're saying is that policy considerations can inform the nature and content of the required standards, but policy discretion has to be constrained by the non-discretionary nature of the obligation.
That's certainly the way 202A2 reads. I agree with you. But what do you think this means? Or whether policy considerations can inform EPA's action should it make such a finding?
That means that in determining the appropriate level and content of the standards, EPA has some discretion applying the criteria in 202A2. And no one here is contesting the level of the standard that has been set. Petitioners aren't saying it should be more or less stringent. They're saying that EPA shouldn't have set any standard at all. And that position is unsupportable.
Okay.
I'd like to next address the argument that EPA should have indefinitely delayed setting standards, applying any discretion it had over timing. EPA's decision to promulgate these standards when it did in 2010 was an eminently reasonable exercise of discretion for at least four separate reasons. First and foremost, as soon as EPA made the endangerment finding, it was then under a non-discretionary duty to promulgate standards. Almost by definition, it cannot be an abuse of discretion for an agency to simply perform the duty that Congress expressly directed it to perform. Second, and very importantly here, if EPA had delayed setting greenhouse gas emission standards for automobiles any further, it would have jeopardized the national program and substantially prejudiced automobile manufacturers and consumers. The Transportation Department was obligated under EPCA to set its fuel economy standards for model year 2012 vehicles 18 months in advance in 2010, so it had no discretion to delay. And as we explain more fully in the brief, if EPA had not acted in coordination with DOT and set standards at the same time, then vehicle manufacturers would have been substantially prejudiced because they would have been in the awkward position of having to comply with an inconsistent patchwork of federal and state standards. They would not have been able to comply with all applicable standards through a single national fleet of vehicles, which they are able to do under the national program that EPA, DOT, and the state of California have all agreed upon. Third, and importantly, it's undisputed here that the technologies to comply with these standards are already commercially available and that these standards are feasible. Any further delay in setting these standards would have resulted in a new generation of vehicles being released into commerce that were not as well controlled for greenhouse gases as they should have been. And such an indefinite delay would have been entirely inconsistent with the fundamental purpose of this statute, which is to protect public health and welfare. Climate change is one of the most urgent environmental threats facing our nation today, and the Clean Air Act contemplates that EPA will take action proactively to address an endangerment. Does not contemplate that EPA will sit idly by indefinitely and allow an endangerment to get worse. And indeed, in this rulemaking, EPA specifically noted the importance of achieving immediate reductions in view of the longevity of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Fourth, this is a situation where over 10 years had already gone by since groups had first petitioned EPA to set standards in 1999. So there had already been a very lengthy period of delay leading up to these standards. Petitioners, of course, have focused on their argument that they focus on the tailoring rule, which, again, is an arguments that are properly raised tomorrow. But I would like to emphasize that the manner in which EPA has has implemented stationary source programs has no bearing on the vehicle standards. The vehicle standards stand on their own. EPA did not endeavor in this rulemaking to interpret or implement the entirely separate stationary source programs in the Act. Nor did EPA have any responsibility in this rulemaking to more generally assess costs related to stationary sources. 202A2 is clear on its face. It directs EPA to set technology-based emission standards, considering costs to automobile manufacturers and available technologies to automobile manufacturers. There's no indication in 202A2 that EPA should be looking at costs under other statutory programs. And as EPA explained in response to comments, if it had done so, it wouldn't have provided any relevant information at all with respect to the appropriate level and content of these standards. Indeed, no matter what standard level EPA had selected, as Your Honor recognized, Judge Tatel, the impacts on, in terms of the trigger on stationary sources was going to be precisely the same. And as EPA indicated, it did intend to, and in fact subsequently did, look at stationary source program cost at the appropriate time, which is in the context of a rulemaking implementing the stationary source programs in the Act.
Are you going to address their argument about the long list of statutory mandates and the implication that that would have allowed EPA to have considered the cost of stationary sources?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
They listed a series of statutes like the Regulatory Flexibility Act, et cetera, and said, well, that would have given you some leeway to consider cost of stationary sources.
EPA was bound by 202A2. That's the language that sets forth the criteria that EPA is supposed to consider in setting vehicle standards.
But and when you issue regulations at the end of the preamble, there's always a statement about all these other statutory mandates. And indeed, you argue in your brief that you addressed all of them.
We did. As set forth in the brief, we fully complied with each of the various procedural statutes they cite, including the Regulatory Flexibility Act, the Unfunded Mandates Reform Act, Clean Air Act Section 317, and the two executive orders they cite. If Your Honor has a particular question, I could address.
The implication of their citation is that that gave you some flexibility, and your argument is just you're back to Section 202A.
Correct. I mean, 202A2 reflects Congress's intent as to what EPA is supposed to be considering in setting these standards.
So I gather from your argument you agree with the automobile manufacturers as to the remedy if there's any problem with the PSD interpretation by EPA?
To the extent in the arguments tomorrow, we'll be prepared to defend all of EPA's actions concerning stationary sources, but to the extent there is any error identified in any EPA action related to stationary sources, it has no bearing at all on the vehicle standards.
So do you agree with the automobile manufacturers about the remedy? That's my question.
Yes. There's just nothing related to stationary sources could infect EPA's vehicle standards, which stand on their own. Finally, I just wanted to characterize or address petitioners' arguments concerning the degree of endangerment alleviated by these standards. Congress in 202A2 directed EPA to set these standards. It did not specify that these standards must ameliorate global climate change to a particular degree. And so their argument that these standards must, in and of themselves, significantly address climate change is really nothing more than an effort to add qualifying language to the duty set forth in 202A1. Put simply, regardless of the degree of endangerment ameliorated through these standards, EPA still had an obligation to set them. And while that resolves the legal arguments, I did want to add that contrary to petitioner's characterization, the record does in fact reflect that these standards will achieve.
Yeah, I don't know why you're even starting with that legal. I mean, as I read EPA's decision, they found, didn't the agency find that the separate motor vehicle emission rules would contribute to the rules that
amelioration.
I mean, yes, yes, Your Honor.
Didn't they find that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I was just commenting on the subsequent non-discretionary nature of the obligation to set standards, not trying to comment on the endangerment finding.
Oh. Okay.
Mobile sources are one of the largest source categories of greenhouse gases. EPA's emission standards by themselves will result in, by 2050, in a 6% reduction in carbon dioxide.
Cadle was mentioning that the agency has made these findings.
Right. I'm just trying to respond to petitioners' characterizations of this rulemaking as not accomplishing anything meaningful. The record does not support that.
The only reason I asked my question is I thought you were saying that they had a legal authority to issue them even if they would have no impact on the environment.
No, that's okay. Not what I was saying.
All right. That's all I asked for.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Unless my colleagues have further questions, your time is up. We'll hear from the intervener, Global Automakers. Ed Al.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Raymond Litvishevsky for the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers and the Global Automakers. Your Honors, this is an unusual case for three interrelated reasons. First, it is unusual because none of the petitioners are directly regulated by the tailpipe rule that they challenge. Second, it is unusual because the industry that is directly regulated by the tailpipe rule, my clients, are here supporting the rule. And third, and perhaps most unusual, it is perhaps most unusual because the petitioners do not raise a single substantive challenge to the tailpipe regulation itself. Their quarrel is with the collateral consequences that arise out of the promulgation of the tailpipe regulation. And simply put,
well, they did just argue that the agency could have issued an air conditioning only rule.
Yes, Your Honor, and I thought that was appropriately dealt with by the panel. It seems to us that a air conditioner only rule would not have survived judicial review. Mm-hmm. So simply put, the auto manufacturer's intervener's position is that these incidental consequences of an otherwise valid rulemaking cannot form the legal basis for striking down the tailpipe rule. As Judge Rogers suggested, in the event that the court agrees with any of the petitioner's contentions concerning the flaws and the collateral regulations surrounding the tailpipe rule, the correct course for the court is to remand and vacate those regulations, leaving the tailpipe rule undisturbed. In our view, one of two things must be true. Either EPA is incorrect in its view that the tailpipe rule automatically triggers stationary source regulation, this of course being the petitioner's contention, and in that case, this court can address those concerns by vacating and remanding the triggering determination or the tailoring rule and leave the tailpipe rule undisturbed. Or alternatively, EPA is correct in its triggering determination, and then there may be issues as to the specific manner, the adequacy of lead time, and other issues raised by petitioners, and those can all be addressed in dealing with the tailoring and the triggering rules.
Do your clients have a view about the combination of the fact that your clients are, that their vehicles don't emit two of the six?
No, Your Honor. EPA has in the past, as has been pointed out, grouped pollutants for the purposes of regulation, and we don't have a position as we don't emit those two chemicals.
Yeah, I'm sorry, what?
And so we don't have a position specifically in this instance because we do not emit those two chemicals. If there are any other questions.
No, but you're not complaining. I was asking the opposite question. The automobile industry doesn't bother the automobile industry that the regulations were issued on the basis of a pollutant, greenhouse gases. It's composed of two gases that your cars don't emit.
No, because it is based upon a regulation of greenhouse gases of the other four of which we are sources for, Your Honor.
If it makes any difference, it would only be as to the stationary sources and not to your client anyway.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the briefly from the intervener, State of California.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I am Deputy Attorney General Gavin McCabe from the California Attorney General's Office. I represent the State of California, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Coalition of State and Environmental Group Interveners in support of Respondent EPA. We join in EPA's arguments, and we believe that EPA did not abuse its discretion in any way in adopting the vehicle rule, and we strongly support the national program that arose from that. I would like to follow up on the argument that EPA could or should have delayed implementing adopting its vehicle rule. And in particular, the assertions in the reply briefs of petitioners that EPA decided against delay because of threats from California and or that California somehow held EPA hostage. Simply put, these assertions are incorrect. California had already adopted its vehicle rule for 2009 to 2016 and had a waiver from EPA. So California was not threatening to do anything, but was simply prepared to move forward with what at that time was the status quo. Its program would be in place for 2009 to 2016, as with the programs in the other Section 177 states which had adopted California's rules. With that said, we do strongly support the national program because it benefits California and the other states because it gets greater greenhouse emissions reductions than we could get on our own. And that's the goal of this, all of this. When California adopts its rules, it hopes for them to be adopted on a national level, and that's what occurred here. I see my time is running out, so if you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer.
Unless there are questions. Thank you.
Sure.
We will give petitioners back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Would you mind starting with the argument that, responding to counsel's argument that the absurd results doctrine, that there's no absurd result in issuing the motor vehicle standards, that the absurd result relates to the stationary sources, and that's where the doctrine should be considered, not here. In other words, we should consider it at the narrowest possible stage, not here.
Yeah.
That is, EPA should.
Yeah, well, but
what's the answer to that?
Yes, but I actually don't think that that's what EPA did in the rulemaking, in the sense of saying that the absurd results happened at some future point after the issuance of the motor vehicle rule. After all, it's their fundamental position that having issued the motor vehicle rule, stationary source regulation is automatically triggered as a matter of law.
Yeah, but their point is there was nothing absurd about issuing the motor vehicle standard.
Yes, but
that's their point. That's what the government just said.
Yes, but if you look at the way that they handled comments on all of this, they told us when we got to the tailoring rule stage that it was too late to argue about other means of dealing with the absurd results that EPA triggered by issuing the motor vehicle rule. They said that happened.
I thought that's what the tailoring rule did.
Yes, but it was only their analysis at the tailoring rule stage was limited by the fact that they had not considered this issue in the motor vehicle rule, because their view was that the tailoring rule, the only course of action left to them was to do something that we think is impermissible, which is to change the thresholds. Our suggestion is that if they had looked at this earlier in the chain of events that they said inevitably would lead to this absurdity, they would have found an interpretation of the statute that was narrower or that would have avoided the absurdity.
That interpretation is what? Thank you.
That interpretation, again, as will be argued tomorrow, and this
No, tell us right now. That interpretation is what?
That interpretation is four fundamental things that could have happened here. Number one, at the endangerment finding stage, they could have said, if these are the links of the chain, we will consider whether or not we should move forward with this regulatory program. Number two and number three, at the motor vehicle stage, they could have said, we will either delay issuance of these regulations or narrow the regulations so that we will not trigger all these absurd consequences. And number four, during the motor vehicle regulation, they could have taken comments on the absurdity that they said would be triggered because it was their interpretation.
Ever take comments?
I'm sorry?
Did they ever take comments?
That is our fundamental problem. And if there's one thing that I would close on right here now is what we have called the shell game, is that when we tried to make these comments during the motor vehicle regulation, they said too early. And when we tried to make them in the tailoring rule, they said too late. Council,
did they receive comments in the tailoring rule proceeding?
They did receive comments in the tailoring rule proceeding, but their response to those comments was too late. And that's what the problem is. They never considered alternatives to addressing this absurdity that were narrower than doing something that we don't think they can do, which is to tailor the thresholds. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Give us recess.
Stand, please. This honorable court now stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m.
Nice job.
It never does. It never does.
She said it, I didn't.
Collect all this tags. I'm going to put them out again tomorrow
morning. Oh, okay.
You can take it with me. I'm going to type up the words. No, here, Carol, tomorrow morning. Here's your souvenir. Because people are not necessarily seeing the same.
Here, Scott. And Shannon, can you hold here for a few minutes?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, you had two of them. And I don't know where the rest went. I just don't even.
There were two that I didn't get in, big thick ones.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's see what we
can do. I can carry at least one more by hand.
You did so great.
Oh, well, thank you. I just sort of didn't get quite far. We didn't get six gases until I got feeling, but that was okay, so we didn't think that. So it all wound up in the right place. I mean, I'm actually overall unsatisfied. There's specific things I would have liked to do differently, but that's okay. The day I give an argument and walk out thinking there's absolutely nothing I would have liked to please.
That's the day you need to retire.
Yeah.
Because
at that point, I'm not being honest with myself.
Or you've just become so brilliant that you're really